children, listen. Let me tell you a story about a village that is built with his glory. No sorrow in this place. Just lift your voice and say,
welcome back to the Village Celebration. All around our nation, there appears to be an awakening, a realization that racism is taking on a violent edge not seen in recent memory. There are social justice and civil rights activists who didn't need awakening, however. They've been woke and they stay woke. That's Christy Griffin is in that category. She's the founder of the Ethics Project and the National Youth Summit, and she is a longtime civil rights advocate as well as an attorney. Dr. Griffin, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Before we go any further, what are your thoughts on Charlottesville?
My thoughts are, and I really like to direct it to the general audience as opposed to those who are actively engaged in the acts of hate and violence, that it's incumbent upon every single individual to be vigilant and to actually act against the types of acts of hatred and violence, those that are overt and covert, because obviously this is beginning to grow beyond what anyone thought would have been possible at this stage. So it's very disconcerting. It's very disturbing. And I think we can certainly blame what has risen. And in fact, David Duke made it very clear that they are following the lead of the President of the United States, that they want to see his wishes fulfilled and his plan fulfilled. And so I think it's very obvious that we now have been so complacent when it comes to voting and expressing our views and opposing the things that we have been witnessing in the last several years, that we now have someone in power who is actually inciting what we saw in Charlottesville.
Do you think history will view Charlottesville as a watershed moment in terms of a national awakening to what has lain dormant in America for a while?
I think it definitely is another watershed moment. And unfortunately, not only did the young lady lose her life by the car that ran into the crowd and the two officers whose helicopter crashed, but also that it has taken, once again, the life of a white person to create the kind of concern and awakening in many people that should have been there before those incidents happened. But we certainly had, as was obvious, so many whites who were shoulder to shoulder with other members of society, with African Americans, who were resisting even the presence of the neo-Nazis and the more violent protesters. But there are many on the fringe who have remained silent, and that silence is just as potent as the active engagement of violence and hate.
To your point that each of us, it's incumbent on each of us now to stand for justice and not just sit silently. The Ethics Project, which you founded, addresses the racial disparity in the criminal justice system by examining the school-to-prison pipeline. how do you address such a deeply entrenched institutional wrong?
We actually take at least a two-pronged approach. One is directing our attention to the system itself, and also by raising awareness. And the raising awareness has taken on a much more prominent role in the work that we do, because we see now that change comes in numbers, that it was the number of people who came out to support an agenda that Donald Trump was purporting during his campaign, that in addition to the, quote, Russian interference, resulted in his actually winning the election. So it's important that people begin to understand what is happening within this system. Mm-hmm. We have been led to believe that our criminal justice system is fair, that it's necessary. They have done a great deal of fear-mongering for decades as politicians, as candidates, in order to easily win the votes of individuals. Once you create that fear, it becomes easy to say, and I will be tough on crime. And it's literally no more than that message is necessary, and you've garnered someone's vote. And if we don't raise awareness among the general population, among the newer generation, the younger generation that is emerging now as our leaders, mm-hmm. They will continue to perpetuate that message and create that fear that makes it so easy for the injustices within the criminal justice system to continue to grow.
You're working with civil rights icons like Ambassador Andrew Young and Reverend C.T. Vivian to reach this younger generation. How do these millennial leaders respond?
They are, one, they have never stopped the work. And I think it's important to understand that these are individuals who are now in their 80s and 90s. And they have continued to do this work. They are continuing to be on the road speaking to individuals and continuing the messages, particularly with Bernard Lafayette, who is not as prominent as many of the other leaders. But without his work, without SNCC sending him into mm-hmm. Selma at his own insistence, mm-hmm. We very possibly may not have seen the gains that we did that came out of the Selma March and the resulting Voting Rights Act. So, and we still have him on the forefront, and he works with us. He has been at each one of our National Youth Summits. He came here to St. Louis several times and has participated in nonviolent training. So they are still very much a part of what is going on now. It's not just a matter of history, although one of the ways that we utilize their presence is for them to convey to these younger participants of the National Youth Summit that they made the choices that they did as very young people, mm-hmm. that a lot of the change that occurred during the civil rights movement of the 1960s came about because of high school students and their diligence and the sacrifices that they made. And by doing that, we hope to encourage this generation to understand their power, even at their age, not as future leaders, but even at this age, to be able to take up that mantle and continue this fight.
And do they recognize the gravity of the situation, do you think?
Do the young people recognize
yes.
the gravity of the situation?
Mm-hmm.
Those that we work with, particularly with the National Youth Summit, who are designated by the administrations within their schools and who also agree to come, they understand the gravity of the situation. The general overall population of young people, I think they were so engrossed in their day-to-day problems that they do not understand the gravity of the situation. And in fact, they have been subjected to so many traumas, and they have been subjected to messaging through the music that they listen to constantly, that their mindset is actually, in my perception, deteriorating. And they are accepting a very negative perception of themselves and a very negative perception of this world, and believe that to be the norm, and will defend their behavior.
So it is, do you think, an even more difficult task now than, say, in the 60s to mobilize the youth?
It is absolutely much more difficult. In the 1960s, the pain was evident. Every then Negro experienced the discrimination. They experienced the fear and the threats and the oppression. And because of that, it became very natural for them to unite. It only takes a common cause, a common question, a common problem to bring people together. And we experienced that during one of our first local youth summits, in bringing students together from what would be considered rival high schools and giving them a common problem to work on and watching them unite and forget about the different factions. So now we move forward into this 21st century, where you have a wide range of experiences within the Black experience. And that would be those who are extremely oppressed, extremely poor, not having engaged in any of the benefits that many of us have been able to experience. You have those who are in public schools. You have those who are transfer students and have a different experience by going to school with whites and being exposed to a different culture there. And then you have the more affluent Blacks, who many don't even relate to being Black or that Black experience, and distance themselves from a lot of what is going on. So it becomes very difficult to unite people under those circumstances. You don't have that one unifying message or one unifying pain that brings people together out of that natural presence of oppression.
The Youth Summit is slated for November, and it's 2 days. Share, if you would, the agenda for those 2 days.
We actually open with a third day, which is optional, understanding that school districts are very clearly experiencing financial challenges. So we have an optional opening day in which the students will come into the Atlanta area and will have an opportunity to tour the various civil rights museums, Dr. King Center for Nonviolence, the grave site of Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, the Memorial Ebenezer Baptist Church, which was Dr. King's church, and the other civil rights museums that are present in Atlanta. And then that evening we will have a ceremony that will introduce the students to, one, a different genre of music and a message through a different genre of music that often they don't hear. So we have a professor from Emory University, who is also a pastor, a musician, and a composer who is composing a jazz program for that evening to convey a message to the students and expose them to that genre of music. And then we will have a passing of the torch that will actually pass a torch from our leader, such as Ambassador Young. Reverend Vivian, because of his age, will actually physically himself pass the torch on that Monday, but someone will pass the torch for him on that Sunday. Dr. Lafayette, Dr. Terrence Roberts, who is one of the Little Rock Nine, and then again two of our other leaders who have been a part of the National Youth Summit and part of our documentary, the Honorable Frankie Freeman. We will have someone pass the torch on her behalf. She is now 100 years old and will not be able to join us. And then Sister Antona Ebo, who was able to participate in the documentary as well as the first Youth Summit, but is now becoming very weakened and will not be able to join us. So there will be an actual passing of the torch and a message from those civil rights leaders to young leaders who have already exhibited an awareness and a commitment to activism within their communities.
And for parents,
I
wanted to know, for parents who are listening and saying this is a great opportunity, is there a way for them to get their child involved?
Absolutely. We have a website that is specifically designated for the National Youth Summit, and the website is thenys.org. So it's thenysyssandsam.org. And there is information on the website, both detailing the actual activities as well as a way to register or contact us with questions.
So even if your child's high school is not participating or has not identified the greatness in your child, you can still find a way to get him or her involved.
Absolutely.
Okay, great.
We would encourage them to engage with the high school and bring it to the high school's attention and have other students come with them. That enhances the experience. If they are under the age of 18, they would have to have an adult participate as well. But they do not have to register through their high school.
And again, that web address is the NYS.org. Dr. Griffin, any final thoughts as we wrap up the interview? A charge going forward for those listening?
The charge going forward is for every single individual to understand their role in this struggle and to be awakened to what is happening now, that we can no longer afford to rest on the laurels and the advances of the 1960s, because we are literally going back in time, and we need every single person to get involved. There is no lack of need. There's no lack of organizations that they can contact and get involved in, and just encourage people to be vigilant and to become active.
Thank you so much, Dr. Christy Griffin, founder of the Ethics Project and the National Youth Summit. We appreciate your insight.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll be right back.
Hi, Amanda. How are you?
Doing really well. How are you settling into your new job?
I like the company, and I really like the town. Just having a hard time finding places for my dry cleaning, car repairs, and restaurant. And I really want to support Black-owned businesses.
Have you tried the app created by the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce? It connects you to Black-owned businesses all around the country.
Sounds great.
It is. It helps you locate Black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's exactly what I need. Thanks.
For more information about the U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org. The recent events in our country have created a grassroots effort
to reallocate assets in a way that sustains and supports the African American community. Some are calling this movement Banking Black or Move Our Money. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce, or USBC, and Liberty Bank have partnered to offer a credit card with a 9.9% interest rate. The U.S. Black Chambers and Liberty Bank, working together in our community. For more information on the credit card, visit libertybank.net/affinity. Use promo code USBC.
Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration Podcast. I'm Vicki Newton. In the midst of the recent turmoil surrounding race relations in our country, Hollywood is turning its attention to the civil rights movement and the race riots in the 1960s. The movie Detroit looks at an incident connected to the 1967 riots in Detroit, specifically a case involving black teenagers who were killed at the Algiers Motel during those riots. Joining me today is Reverend Lonnie Peek, who was a young student at Wayne State University in 1967. Reverend Peek, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Vicki, for having me.
The days of rioting, because there were 5 days or so, they actually started at a party to welcome two Vietnam veterans home. Police arrived at what they called an illegal bar, and things escalated from there. What was Detroit like in the summer of 67?
Okay, first of all, from a standpoint of perspective, what we in Detroit, we call it the 1967 rebellion. We don't really call it a riot. Hollywood attacked it onto that, and we have vehemently said that, no, it wasn't a riot. It was a rebellion based upon police suppression. The situation was, as you had stated, it was an after-hours joint that was celebrating a party, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and when police came, there were more people there than they thought. Mm-hmm. There was about 80-some people there, and things kind of escalated as the police moved the individuals outside into the paddy wagon, and even though it was 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, there were a lot of people on the streets hanging out, and they became disturbed after what they saw about moving the individuals from the bar itself, and some pushing and some shoving began, and the match was lit, and that sparked the whole activities that carried on for the next 5 days.
In the midst of those 5 days, three teenagers were killed at the Algiers Hotel. What happened there?
Well, that in itself is a story, more than a story. These three individuals were at the Algiers Motel up on Woodward Avenue, and they were escaping what was happening on the street. One of them was a member of the Dramatics and had just left. No, two of them were just members of the Dramatics and just left rehearsal. And because of what was happening in the street, they found themselves in the hotel. Well, the hotel was packed with people. Motel was packed with people, and there were two white women. Young girls from Ohio, and they were part of, you know, just hanging out and dancing and drinking and doing what they were doing. And one of the individuals had a starter pistol, and he was messing around with the starter pistol and fired the starter pistol. Police heard the starter pistol, thought they allegedly it was a sniper, which it was not, and they stormed the motel. And for the next several hours, they harassed and eventually killed the three teenagers. What they were doing was they were trying to find out who shot the rifle at them, you know, who was the sniper. And they kept saying it was not a sniper, it wasn't a sniper. And they decided to take them into individual rooms. And the first two that went into the individual rooms, they acted like they had shot them, but they didn't. Well, when the third police officer had his chance to take him into the room, he made an assumption that the other police officers had shot the other teenagers, which they did not do, and he shot him. So from that point on, the other two were shot, and it turned into just a horrible, horrible, dreadful situation. So that was based upon the rebellion, what was happening in the street. The Algiers Motel incident was a sidebar that mm-hmm. grew and had its own a life of its own through mm-hmm. the police brutality. And the connectivity from that 50 years ago, we still are facing the same type of police mentality of killing black boys. And, well, they were black men killing teenagers. So that situation has not gone away.
When you look back at 1967 and you were a young college student, where were you in the midst of the rioting?
Well, what had happened was I was, as you mentioned, I was a student, full-time student, working on my master's degree at Wayne State University. I was married, had a family, had two kids, so I was not just no young dude just hanging out. And physically where we lived probably, 2 to 3 miles from where the whole disturbance began. On the streets where we lived, decent streets. There was no, turmoil on the individual streets where we were. But as you went further towards the center, which was 12th and Claremont, then it spread. So where I was physically, I was close enough to hear, and then you could see, obviously see the smoke. And the way I got involved in the observing and being a part of the disturbance was my aunt called me on Ali, bless her heart. She called me about 12 o'clock that Sunday. We didn't go to church that Sunday. I guess I should have been in church. We didn't go to church, and she said, Lonnie, something's jumping off over down there on 12th Street. And we went down and we saw it. Then it spread throughout the city because it was on the east side and the west side. So it was not like an isolated piece. And as the days rolled on with the incoming of the feds and the National Guard, it just moved to a situation where tanks were rolling up and down the street, and you became an occupied city, if you will.
Mm-hmm. 7,000 people were arrested.
Yes. Yes, you're right. It turned in, and the situation of them being arrested was just horrendous, if you can imagine. The feeling, I guess, of terror and fright has not left. Mm-hmm. As I'm talking to you, it's like it's going on like right now. It doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the way we became involved in this situation is that after the Algiers Motel murders, my friend and I, Dan Alders, who was from New York, he would always come past my house. He and my wife were good friends. She was from New York. And we started talking about a people's tribunal that was held in Stockholm, Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided that, that we need to do something. Instead of just saying we need to do something, we're going to do something. So for 2 weeks, probably about 2 to 3 weeks, we started to organize what was known as the People's Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
People's Tribunal was bringing together community activists. We had prominent lawyers, situations of people of the community, one being Rosa Parks. We put together a jury. We put together a prosecuting attorney. We put together a judge. And we decided we were going to hold a People's Tribunal to try these three police officers. It was held at the Shrine of the Black Madonna. And on the day of the event, literally thousands of people came out. I'll never forget, it was a hot August evening. People couldn't get up and down the street because people couldn't get into church. So it was just blocked off. And what we did for 3.5 hours in a hot summer night, no air conditioning, we tried these three police officers and we found them guilty. And our particular message was, this is a mock trial. This is no way giving you the need to go out and execute or shoot police. It's not about that. It's about us bringing our facts together. See, the trial had not happened, but we made an assumption that the police officer was going to get off, which they did.
They did. Mm-hmm.
we were doing is putting together our own trial, and we firmly believe that based upon what we did, that we were able to diffuse a lot of the hostility about the trial because we had already conducted our own trial.
You indicated that all of these years post-rebellion, there's still that fear. Do you think Detroit ever recovered from what happened in 67?
I think that the, and that's a good question, the recovery, I think that the event itself is permanently etched in your memory. But what happened was a lot of positive things came out of that. In 1973, we had election of our first black mayor, Mayor Coleman Young, and he was a state senator, and he ran on a platform of dismantling stress. Stress was called Stop the Robbery, Enjoy State Streets. These were police officers who acted like they were, you know, bums and hobos, and they basically was an entrapment. And some 87 people, black men, had been killed by stress. So Coleman did away with that. He put together a police commission of citizens, first time that had been enacted, and he started to integrate the police force. And that had a lot to do with attitudes changing. Now, as it relates to right now, the relationships we have with the police force, they're decent. Chief Craig has made a tremendous, he's our current chief, has made a tremendous effort in having community policing. And not to say, you know, bad things don't happen, but it's not the atmosphere that was back 50 years ago. And so the police are viewed upon a little bit differently. And as you probably are aware, Detroit, coming out of its bankruptcy 3 years ago, is on the leaps and bounds forward. It is miraculous what has happened in the city of Detroit. If you try to get an apartment or a condo downtown or mid-city, you can't, because there's lists. There are lists of people trying to rent, to buy. If you try to store your furniture in places that store furniture, you can't, because it's all full. So Detroit has made a tremendous rebound in the last 3 years. As you're probably aware, we got a new arena that's opening up the end of this month, right downtown. We will have, the Pistons are coming back downtown now. We have the hockey downtown, we have baseball downtown, we have basketball. So we have all four of the major sports downtown. There's development. People are falling all over themselves to get property. Property values are going up. In our community where we live, and we're blessed, we live in what is known as Sherwood Forest. It's decent. I mean, it's really decent. It's two major communities, neighborhoods, Detroit Palmer, Palmer Woods, and Sherwood Forest. And then there is the English Village. There are university districts. The housing here. You want to try to come and get, you want to buy my house right now? Can't do it. Going up. What I'm saying is that it ain't all doom and gloom in Detroit. Yeah, we got problems, but we are definitely on the rebound.
That is so exciting to hear, because I'm a big fan of Detroit. I lived there in Sherwood Forest in the late 90s on Cambridge. So I'm excited to hear all the good things that are happening. You mentioned the positive relationship between the police department and the residents. When we look across the American landscape, there are a lot of urban areas that cannot say the same. What are your thoughts?
Well, what I think it has been a concerted effort to break down barriers and have the community relate to and deal with the police department. The mayor has been very strong. And hey, we have a white mayor. Can you get to that? 80% of the
in Detroit.
Yeah, but we got a white boy as a mayor. Now, what's up with that? You know what I'm saying? But he's been a good mayor. He's been an excellent mayor, and he has a good relationship with the black community. He relates very well to black folks. There's that camaraderie there, and there's the relationships there. So as it relates to the police department, all I eyes are on the police department. But see, I've always contended, when you get in trouble and something has happened, who do you call? You call the police.
Sure.
So you have to have good relationships with the police department. We have been blessed. We've been blessed that we have had good relationships. That not perfect relationship. Yeah, there's still some fools out there. Yes, there are. But in Detroit as a whole, we have good relationships with our police department.
And we're going to leave it on a positive note. Reverend Lonnie Peek, who has been in Detroit through the rebellion in 67 and through the turnaround and then another turnaround, we're glad good things are happening in Detroit. Perhaps what you all have done can be a model for the rest of the country. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me. We really appreciate you telling our message. Be blessed.
You're listening to The Village Celebration, and we'll be right back.
My daughter made me this cute bottle with a little water in it. Until I can quit smoking, I can stop flicking cigarette butts and put them in here when I drive. They're litter, plain and simple. This is my way to help keep Arkansas beautiful.
For every ton of paper we recycle, we save 17 trees. I really like trees. Recycling helps keep Arkansas beautiful.
A message from the station.
The Arkansas Broadcasters Association
and Keep Arkansas Beautiful.
Honey, did you read this article in the newspaper?
The one about supporting our black-owned businesses?
Yes, that one. It also said Asian Americans keep a dollar in their community 26 days, Hispanics 21, and we, African Americans, only 6 hours?
What can we do to support our businesses?
Well, here's one way. The U.S. Black Chambers of Commerce has an app that helps locate black-owned businesses in dozens of cities.
That's a wonderful idea. Where's my phone?
For more information about the free mobile app, go to usblackchambers.org.
Hello and welcome to the Village Celebration. Summer is winding down, but that doesn't mean your travel plans have to do the same. Joining us today is Tiffany Owens, who is the founder of a travel and fashion blog called Compact and Compass, headquartered in Houston, Texas. Tiffany, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Vicki. Thank you so much for having me. I'm super excited.
Well, I saw where you were in Paris over the summer, and those of us who didn't get to travel over the summer can still do so in the fall. Do you find that people do a lot of traveling in the fall, specifically your target audience, African Americans?
They do still travel. You know, I must admit that travel during the summer happens to be a lot more expensive, of course, because it's the peak season. A lot of people are on summer vacation. The kids are out of school. So a lot of people want to travel during the summer. But still, even in the fall, there's still a lot of travel going on. There's so many great destinations that people can travel to during the fall.
So I love the name of your blog, Compact and Compass. Where can we take both of those in the fall for a good price point? Any suggestions?
Yeah, and so first I want to give a quick tip. So on August 22nd, on average, U.S. domestic fares will get cheaper. So you definitely want to look out for August 22nd because you can start making your travel plans for the fall then. I know that some great places to go would be Aspen, especially if you're looking for a great kind of scenery. Aspen is such a cute little town. I actually went in the winter for skiing, and so it was very beautiful. The people are nice, great food, and it's just a beautiful sight to see. So that's one place I would recommend during the fall and even the winter as well.
You know, we think fall foliage and heading east or out west. What about those fall foliage trips?
That's exactly what I was thinking about for Aspen, the fall foliage, for sure. Even in New York, there's some great places to see. some really good, you know, picturesque views. I'm definitely a picture taker, selfie taker, you know, what have you. So I love to capture the great scenes of nature. And even going to the West Coast, Oregon has some really beautiful views. I love waterfalls as well. Mm-hmm. They make for a really beautiful backdrop. So that's a great place to go. Portland, Columbia, along the Columbia River as well, in Oregon. So definitely check out those places.
Those are some great ideas. And then, of course, we head into the holiday season, Thanksgiving, and then on into Christmas, when everyone seems to pack up and head to grandma's house or to visit family and friends. When is probably the best time to start looking for travel fares?
Right now. Because the earlier you book, especially during the holidays, it'll be more cheaper. Because, you know, if you wait closer to the time frame of the holiday, for Thanksgiving to Christmas, fares jump up significantly. So you do want to start making those holiday travel plans right away, as soon as possible. You also don't want to wait 2 weeks in advance. You want to wait, you know, at least now or a month in advance to do your travel booking for the holidays.
And for football fans, you can always pack up the car or maybe get a cheap flight and see your favorite professional team or your favorite college team during the fall.
Oh, yes, for sure. So, you know, I have to admit, I'm not huge on going to football games, but, you know, being that I am from Arkansas, so by default, I always cheer for the Razorbacks, of course.
Of course, of course.
I know one of the big games that's coming up, LSU is a big rival, Ole Miss is a big rival. So a lot of those games, you can actually just take a road trip, you know, put the family in a van and just take a quick road trip to some of those destinations. And then, of course, you know, flying is another option, bus, train, anything that is least expensive and that fits into your budget. So you definitely want to compare the prices of what it takes to get to those destinations.
A road trip sounds great. I love road trips.
Those are always fun, right?
Yeah, those are always fun. You have to have pork rinds, in my opinion, though. Pork rinds and Hostess cupcakes. But anyway, I digress. So it's compact and compass. Before we let you go, one question. Looking good when you travel, that seems to be such a challenge. How do you fly or drive and still reach your destination looking kind of cute? What's your best, quote-unquote, travel uniform?
Okay, so I like to be comfortable, so I always take a sweater with me because it gets kind of cold on the plane. But I like to always wear black, you know, maybe like some workout pants or just a black sundress or something. And, you know, it keeps me, I guess, still looking good. And I always like go freshen up in the bathroom, you know, touch up on the makeup and all that. So before anyone sees me, I have to take that quick bathroom break and freshen up on the makeup and make sure my hair is together, because I'm always the one who's sleeping on the plane. I know it's hard for some people but I like to sleep and get my rest on the plane. So I always have to take that quick bathroom break before anybody sees me. And I always have my mirror with me in hand too, so just in case. I have my compact with me.
Compact and compass. Well, Tiffany Owens, thank you so much for joining us to share travel tips. We look forward to taking to the friendly skies or hitting the roadways in the next few weeks and months. Thank you again.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to the Village Celebration.